everything you got. Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown! You are listening to the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Now here's your host, Brand Duffy.
That's right. Another week and the 2016 NFL season is officially over as the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast continues. I'm Fran Duffy, and as always, I think we've got a great show for you here on episode number 91. At the top of this week's show, we've got Chalk Talk, where I chat with our good buddy Greg Cosell, makes his first appearance in just over a month to talk about something near and dear to our hearts, tape study. What does Greg get from it? Why is it so important? How he got into the business of studying coaching tape. So if you're interested in learning more about the game, this will be a really interesting podcast for you because Greg really gets into how and why he began to watch the All-22. Next up in our scouting report, I went on Twitter to find out who all of you wanted to hear my notes on as we get closer to the scouting combine, and you guys suggested a prospect I'm really excited about. Find out who that player is later in the show. We have got a ton to get into with Greg, so let's not waste any time. Greg and I talk about the importance of All-22 and what you can learn from tape study. Let's get to that chat now in Chalk Talk.
Let's get down to business. It's time for Chalk Talk.
Joining me for the first time in a long time, it feels like it's been too long, Greg. thanks for joining us here once again on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast, NFL film senior producer Greg Cosell. Greg, we're here in the middle of the offseason.
And we were thinking Super Bowl after the 3-0 start, weren't we?
Yes, we were. It feels like a long time ago. Yeah. But here we are now. It's the offseason. And I want to talk to you about it. This is something that, you know, listeners and followers on Twitter and people that subscribe to the podcast ask all the time is just talking about how he got into watching the tape. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to have this discussion, there's no one better to have the discussion about the value of the tape than with Greg Cosell. So first I wanted to ask you, and this is the question I'm sure you get a lot. How did you first get into it when you're talking about tape study and watching coaching tape at the NFL level?
Well, here's the deal. I grew up in Queens in New York, and my high school did not have a football team. So I played baseball and basketball. So I got a job at NFL Films. I've been there 37 years. Started in 1979, and in 1984 we started, Steve Sable and I started the NFL Matchup Show. We didn't have coaching tape at that point, so we would shoot specific stuff with NFL Films cameras. And then around 91, 92, we got the coaching tape. And because I'd never really seen true coaching tape because I didn't have a background playing football, and I was producing a show that was about X and O football with former players, I said to myself, in order to do this show properly, I need to learn the game through the coaching tape.
When the game when the show started in 84, what did you guys, so the angles that you guys
we
shot?
No, we would, when it started in 84, the show was called Monday Night Matchup, and we just did the Monday Night game.
Got it.
So all we did was the week before, we would send a special end zone camera to the two teams that were playing the following Monday night. So it was, you know, it wasn't ideal, but hey, that's the way it was. We didn't even know what we were doing back then, believe me.
You didn't know what you didn't know.
We didn't know a lot.
Yeah.
So we got the coaching tape, and like I said, I just felt like I needed to learn the game in order to produce this show the right way. So I could have valid and meaningful discussions with the on-air talent who are former players and not just say, hey, you've got 30 seconds to say that or 20 seconds to say that, you know, as a lot of producers. We all do that as producers. That's just the reality of the TV business. So I started watching it, and I'd always been, when I played basketball and baseball through college, I'd always thought the games. That's just the way I played sports. So I started watching coaching tape, and I was fortunate to be around a lot of people, you know, through connections. Ron Jaworski, Phil Sims, a lot of coaches, you know, just through the years. And because I didn't play, I saw this watching the tape as kind of an academic and intellectual exercise. I wasn't just watching tape to watch football. I was trying to understand the game, and it took me a long time. And first of all, you're always learning, so I don't want people to think that, hey, I know football and that's it.
And there's
no
question about that.
But I mean, I would say it took me 3-4 years before I even sort of felt comfortable having meaningful conversations about what was on the tape. And then the game's always changing, so you feel like you learn something, and then there's something else you have no idea about. So it's an ongoing process. Steve Sable did a great thing for me going back to maybe 1999, where he came to me and said, hey, you need to go to the NFL scouting combine every year and spend time talking to people. And I started going, and I just, the first year, I mean, I knew nobody. And you just start, you know how it goes. You just start talking to people.
Yep.
You build up relationships. That, like I said, that was back in 99. You start talking football. You just grind away doing the work. And hopefully you build up some respect, and then people talk to you more, and they realize you're trying to do it the right way. And, you know, over the years, I've learned that I never make any comments without studying coaching tape. And I've been very, very fortunate that, you know, people started to think maybe I knew something about the game and knew a little bit about what I was talking about and got a chance to do some radio and TV. But even to this day, I will not talk about a team or a game without watching the coaching tape and seeing the all 22 and then the end zone. I just won't.
It's really interesting because you brought up how, you know, your high school didn't have a football team. And this is what I always kind of come to grips with, because obviously, you know, living in Philadelphia, and I grew up in Philadelphia, I grew up a diehard Eagles fan, and you know, the Eagles were everything, you know, growing up, the Eagles
sure.
were everything. When I grew up, when I went to, you know, through middle school, through high school, I didn't play for my high school football team. You know, I played every other sport growing up. I played hockey, I played soccer, I played basketball, baseball. But never played organized football through my school. So, you know, didn't get that same education that obviously that you were able to get right around the same time. obviously, I was significantly younger at a different stage of life. But, you know, as I'm going through and I was kind of the same way as you playing sports growing up, where, you know, I was really trying to get around inside the mind of a coach as we were playing basketball and trying to understand, okay, what kind of scheme are we running? What was the strategy behind what we were doing with playing baseball? And I think a lot of fans are the same way. Fans grow up and they, you know, when they're kids, everybody played baseball. Everybody played basketball outside. Everybody kind of can watch those games, and they're more individualized sports. Whereas football is not an individualized sport at all. And that's what I think is it makes it so much fun to study. And I know you kind of feel the same
way
about it.
I do.
There's so many factors.
And over the years, I've really become much more fascinated by schemes than I am by, let's say, individual players. Like, you know, so many times through the years I'd get phone calls from, whether it's, you know, the Peter Kings of the world asking me, you know, who's your all-pro, you know, right guard? And, you know, 10 years ago I would have been able to answer that a lot better than I can answer it now, to be honest, because right now I am so fascinated by schemes. Now, am I still watching players at times? Without question. But to me, the game, and quick story, because I hopefully it's interesting.
Yeah.
I had a chance, you know, it must have been now 6-7 years ago, to do a book with Ron Jaworski and a colleague of mine at NFL Films, David Plowd,
who's
an unbelievable writer.
Yep.
He did, I did a ton of the research, Dave did a ton of the writing, and you know, Jaws was just, Jaws, great, you know, he does what he does. But I had a great conversation with Dick LeBeau, because one of the chapters was on Dick LeBeau pioneering the zone blitz. And he started talking to me about how, as he was putting together all these zone blitz concepts in his mind and on paper, he started thinking of the field in quadrants. And he says, I didn't explain it to the players that way, but that's the way I saw it. And, you know, just hearing that kind of thing, and the fact that I saw watching the All-22 was kind of an intellectual experience when I started, I just put those together and found it so fascinating, because that's the way coaches see all this. You know, it's not just, oh, let's go out and hit someone in the mouth. Let's go out and make a play. You know, you just got to make plays.
Right.
You know, coaches don't think like that. They don't see the game. Now, ultimately, does someone have to do that? Of course. We know that. You know, just like when a guy comes up in the ninth inning in baseball and you need a base hit, you got to get a base hit. They don't necessarily think about what goes into how he battles the pitcher, you know, all the things that go into it. But to me, football is such a nuanced game with so many elements, so many schematics. That is what fascinates me about football.
Yeah, and when you mentioned it, you know, when you have the scenario, like when a cleanup hitter comes out in the bottom of the ninth inning and he's able to hit a home run, and everyone could see, oh, wow, it was a 2-1 pitch, and he put it into the left field bleachers.
And he's clutch,
right.
Right, right.
Or, you know, a basketball player.
Right.
Where it's 5-on-5, one player can go out, and he could take over
right,
a game
right,
and
right.
be that guy and change a game. Whereas, you know, I think back to the season, you talk about, you know, Carson Wentz, why didn't he throw this deep ball? Or why did he throw this deep ball? You know, Fletcher Cox, how come he didn't have any sacks in this game?
Or right,
one
right,
tackle
right.
in this game? there are so many things. You know, the Eagles gave up a big run. I can remember the 72-yard run that they gave up this past year in the Seattle game to C.J. Procise.
I remember it well.
Everybody was in the right gap. And honestly, all 11
guys.
That's
when Baldwin went in motion.
Correct.
That was when Mills was right in the
But Mills got brought inside. It was a great play designed by Seattle trying to isolate C.J. Procise on Jalen Mills in the C-gap. They got exactly what they wanted. But everybody was in the right gap. You just missed it. Your rookie seventh round pick coming in motion, missed a tackle. So it's when everybody else is right and one guy can make one small error based off of one slight adjustment from the opposing team, it throws everything out of whack.
You know, it's so funny with social media now, and I know you see this too, so many guys now take screenshots and they'll show you a play. Oh, look at this receiver. He's open, and that's where the ball should have gone. And then, you know, sometimes I'll look on Twitter, you know, when I'm watching a game, and I'll see this, and then I go in and I watch the tape and I look at the play and it just happens to hit. And I, you know, and I say to myself, God, that's so unfair to do that because it really doesn't reflect anything about the play. You know, the read was to the other side of the field where the three receiver route was, and they picked out a guy that wasn't even in the read. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons I love this stuff so much, because you see how all this plays out. And I've been so fortunate to be able to really learn, you know, all these different route concepts, all these different coverages, pass protections, which have become increasingly complicated and complex because of what defenses do. And this, to me, is the fascinating part of football. It's all these subtle disciplines, and coverages now have become something I'm so fascinated with, because there's so many more coverages than there used to be. There's so many more combinations. You know, we used to talk about cover two or man or cover three. Now you get cover three boundary lock, what we have, where you lock the receiver to the short side of the field. You see cover four boundary lock. You know, I mean, there's all different kinds of coverage. They just seem to be adding teams that play, you know, man on the outside, zone in the middle. There's just so many different combinations.
What was the hardest part as you were continuing to learn about the game? I mean, obviously still learning to continue learning about the game. What has been the hardest part for you to try and get a beat on? You know, is it the coverage schemes? Is it the quarterback reads? Is it the protection?
Protection, I find, can be difficult. Just because there's so many different fronts now, Fran. You know, you try to figure out which five guys that the offensive linemen are trying to, are responsible for. That's what you're trying to figure out. Now, sometimes it's blatantly obvious. A lot more times in today's NFL, it's not so blatantly obvious, because then you have to figure out who the back. If you figure out the five that the offensive linemen are responsible for, then you have to figure out then who the back might have, and then who the quarterback might have if there's an unblocked player. And sometimes that can be really difficult, and you just keep going. That's where you watch a play 20 times, and you just keep walking through it, and you just try to go through and do it through process of elimination.
What are your favorite games within a game to watch? Is you're turning on a film of any random side of the ball, whether it's how the pressure scheme attacks the protection.
Two things.
Okay, go ahead.
Routes versus coverage.
Okay.
Pressure schemes
there
by defense.
Okay. Well, what is it about those two that kind of sets it apart?
I'm just fascinated. It comes from a conversation. I was the listener, obviously. Mike Martz was very good to me years ago and invited me out when he was the head coach of the Rams. And I spent about 3-4 days out there. And he basically said, you're a coach. Do whatever you want. Hang out in any meeting you want. Do whatever. You know, you're a coach. I didn't really say anything. There was nothing for me to say. I was just there. But one thing I learned from him was you have to understand all the details of all the specific zone coverages in order to break them down with your route concepts. And I never forgot that. So that part of the game always fascinates me, how route concepts break down coverages. So to me, that is a fascinating part of the game.
Interesting.
And then all these pressures now, which, you know, I find with you know, obviously second-level players, third-level, meaning linebackers, third-level players, meaning defensive backs, those, to me, if you're an offensive coach, you're an offensive lineman, those have to be so difficult. I mean, sometimes I wonder how offensive linemen do it, because, you know, first of all, these guys are such better athletes than they are.
Of course.
And where they come from, you know, so I find that part really fascinating as well.
So I would agree, and here are the two like little kind of subtopics in each, inside of each. The one thing about the pass concepts against coverage that has always really intrigued me is the idea that, you know, obviously, look, you're running one concept on one side and you're often
right.
running a different concept on the other. I love when coaches and the thinking, the thought process behind this of putting different concepts on each side that can attack different coverages to make it easy for the quarterback. So if a quarterback drops back.
A lot of coaches do that. They have a man side and a zone side with the route concepts.
Or a one high side and a two high
side.
Just something to kind of give the quarterback options. And I love that style of thing, you know, just the thought process.
That was actually done on a play you'll remember very well when Carson Palmer hit John Brown for a 75-yard touchdown to beat the Eagles.
Right, on the quarters beater.
The quarters beater, because that was what
this
they
was
had.
Now, this was now 3 years,
three
years ago.
Right, it just happened. It's one of those plays I remember very well just because I know that's what happened.
Right.
Where they had the vertical part of the route on that side, and Brown ran the quarters beater, and they had let's get the first down part of the route on the other side, and the coverage presented itself on the left. It was on the left, I believe. And Carson Palmer saw it, and that's where he threw it.
It's really fascinating for that standpoint. And then the other, from a pressure standpoint against protections, the stuff I love watching. Number one, I love watching pressures against empty protections.
Got it.
And with all the empty.
You can always get someone clean if you want to.
I love the way that teams try to disguise it. That stuff always gets me.
And there's a lot of teams, and Buddy Ryan started this back in the day, something called BTF, blitz to formation.
Blitz to formation, right.
And there's a lot of teams that will have automatic checks on defense versus specific formations, empty being one of them, where they then pressure because they know they can get someone clean.
I can remember, I think it was the first time under Chip Kelly that the Eagles played the Dallas Cowboys at home, and I think it was a loss. It was at Lincoln Financial Field, and the Cowboys had just played a game where they played a ton of empty. And in that game, when the Eagles played Dallas here, Bill Davis checked those. There was a lot of BTF in that game where whenever they went empty, they lined up.
We talked about
that. It was really good stuff.
Yeah, we talked about that at the time. I remember it really well.
Yeah. So I love that. And then also, I love the double mug stuff. I love the not just even the what teams do. Officer, we're talking about Mike Zimmer when you have the two linebackers up in the A-gap and all the different things that go along with that. Now,
see, what
I say Mike Zimmer, but everybody does it now.
What I love that teams now have really added to that. And I remember the first number of times. I can't remember the first time I saw it. I just remember seeing it with Miami years ago when Todd Bowles was actually with Miami at the time, where teams add that third A-gap blitz or the triple A-gap blitz, which is you really can't pick that up.
Yeah. No, and then you saw this past year with Minnesota where they're not sending a third A-gap blitzer, but that one of the defensive tackles lined up in the B-gap is not a defensive tackle at all, and he's actually a defensive end stood up in the B-gap. So
Brian Robeson.
Now you've got three guys that can kind of move around and do different things for you very close to the center, and therefore
it's funny you mention that because another thing that's really become prevalent in the league, which is fascinating to me as well because it relates to pressure, is – all the stunts now, the inside stunts. We used to just see stunts, you know, tackle end stunts, what we call TE stunts, or ET stunts where the end goes first, a tackle loop, the basic conventional stunts. Now we see so many more stunt concepts than we ever used to see.
Were there any big trends, and this is not necessarily just pressure stuff, but were there any big trends that you noticed over the last year, maybe even 2 years? That
it relates to what we're talking about. Ton of teams now out of their nickel and dime fronts, 2-3 techniques. That is so prevalent in the NFL now.
Why do you think so?
Because if you also then line up someone head up over the center, which a lot of teams do, they almost line up with a five across front. There are so many different pressure concepts that you can do from that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's one of the things. I know the Eagles did that a little bit this year with Jordan Hicks, lining him up head up over the center in some of those sub-package downs. It is something that I definitely noticed as well. Here's a question for you. What are some of the little things that you pick up when you watch coaching tape? And there's lots of things that you pick up. But some of the little things that you pick up that maybe you don't necessarily see when you watch the game live on TV?
Well, coverage is the first thing because you can't see coverage on television. Coverage and routes. And those are two things that fascinate me. So I guess my eyes go to that, you know, certainly on pass plays, obviously. But my eyes go right to that. I'm always fascinated by what teams do from a coverage standpoint. just because it's I find it interesting. And then, as I said, how teams attack that with routes. And you can't see any of that on TV. And to me, that in a league where passing is far outweighs running, that is such a critical element. And there's nothing on TV that shows that.
Greg, let me ask you one big topic that we could probably talk for, you know, 90 minutes or 90 days just about this one topic, but we'll squeeze it into, you know, 5-6 minutes here. Analytics, the term analytics, are obviously squeezed into one big umbrella term now that everybody just kind of, anything associated with numbers, oh yeah, it's analytics. All coaches work with analytics because that's how they work on their game.
They worked with it before it was called analytics.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, that's how they formulate their game plans every week.
It's a piece of the puzzle.
Of course. When you look at analytics now in terms of the new age, quote-unquote,
right,
statistics and the next level stats that people are able to provide, you know, in terms of, you know, air yards and that a quarterback throws and all the different stats that go along with, you know, unblocked yards for a running back. What are your thoughts when you go? Because I always have trouble with some of those, because with every single one of those stats, I can look at it and say, well, there's one reason why, and I know what you're trying to get by, oh, well, if a guy is really low on air yards, it's because, you know, he doesn't want to throw the ball downfield. But I can think of a lot of reasons why a guy's air yards would be low as well. And I feel that way about lots of those, you know, next level stats as well.
I'm always a little leery of that because, like I said, I think anytime – more information is always better than less information.
No doubt.
But I think, to me, they don't tell you how something happened, okay? They give you a cumulative number, and particularly if the sample size gets larger and larger, but they don't tell you how it happened. So if you tell me that, you know, the Eagles give up X amount of yards in the pass game when they play man coverage, okay, if we're talking about 100 plays, that's a large sample of plays. But it doesn't tell me about those plays specifically.
Right.
You know, and that's what I would want to know. I would want to know, you know, if you tell me, well, such and such a team runs really well out of 6 O-line personnel and they've run the ball 82 times this year for 5.6 yards a carry out of 6 O-line personnel. That's great. That's a great number.
Yep.
That doesn't tell me what kind of runs. It doesn't tell me where that 6th offensive lineman lines up. Are they running zone runs? Are they running power runs? What are they doing? It doesn't tell me that.
Yeah.
So to me, and again, I'm not the analytics expert, so someone listening might say, I don't know what I'm talking about. I remember reading Moneyball when it came out, whenever it came out, and I spent one summer for about 2 months just messing around with what I believed were similar concepts with football, and I didn't quite see this specific correlation. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people way smarter than I am who could sit and tell me there's a great correlation and here it is, although I've had some of these conversations. And most of the conversations end up with this person who knows way more than I do telling me, hey, it's just another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with that because, like I said, more information is better than less information. But I think you have to be careful in a sport where there's 22 moving pieces on every single play about
not to mention all the other external factors, the play call and the weather
and all
that other stuff. But yes.
I think you have to be a little careful about making definitive judgments based on that.
Yeah, I would agree, especially when, you know, now we're in draft season and everybody wants to talk about, you know, things like, oh, well, this back average yards, this amount of yards per carry, and this receiver average, you know, X amount of yards per catch. And it's like, well, you know, they may have gotten an 85-yard touchdown on another 78-yard touchdown on a blown coverage and a guy where the DB fell down. Like, there's lots of things where you can look at it and say, where the numbers got a little bit tweaked because of, of a couple of different outliers.
To me, there's just too many variables in football. It's not the pitcher versus the hitter.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's really what it really comes down to for me is that I think when you look at these other sports that all of us kind of grew up playing, and I say all of us as an umbrella.
Right, right.
Well, that most Americans, I feel like, grew up playing, they're more individualized sports and people have a better understanding of those sports. And they look at a game like football and they say, well, yeah, it should be the same thing. This guy got beat by this guy, therefore this guy's bad, this guy's good.
Right.
End of story.
Right.
That's just not the case all the time.
No, not in football. Yeah. Not in football. It's hard. And like I said, you know, maybe it's something I should revisit and maybe I'll talk more to people about it, you know, this year at the Combine, you know, or next year at the Combine, whenever that is. But or just in general. But I don't know. I'm not certain. It's another piece of the puzzle.
Another piece of the puzzle. Well, Greg, appreciate the time. Just join us to talk a little bit of football here at the Novacare Complex on another off-season week here.
Can't be talking football, Fran.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely right. So, Greg Cosell, NFL Films, appreciate the time as always here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Talk to you soon. Great stuff from Greg. And again, you can follow him on Twitter just like I do, at Greg Cosell. And while you're at it, I'm at FDuffy3. That's where I post all of the podcasts I'm a part of and all of our X's and O's content that we produce here at PhiladelphiaEagles.com. And you know I greatly appreciate everybody that promotes this podcast on social media. That's just one way to support the show. But the other is to go on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen, and you give us a rating and you leave us a comment. I wanted to give a shout out to Musafa W, who left a comment on our Lipston page with a question. With the thought of going for Dalvin Cook in the first and Cordrea Tankersley, the cornerback from Clemson, the second, so he's giving us a little mock draft here, what would be your thoughts on receivers available in the third round? So you're saying if they went corner and running back in rounds one and two, are there some receivers that interest me in the third round? So I'll give you a few names. I'll give you five names right off the bat. You guys know I'm a big fan of Taywan Taylor from Western Kentucky. Love his hands, his ball skills, good route runner, everything about his game. I really love Taywan Taylor. But since he's only 5'11", 198 pounds, I do think there's a chance he could potentially fall to the third round. So we'll see how that goes with him. I love D.D. Westbrook on tape. You know, obviously there's reportedly some off-field issues you got to worry about. There's some potential injury concerns moving forward. He is a little bit smaller, listed at 5'11", 171, so very slight frame. But on tape, has the speed, the quickness, good route runner. I like the way he tracks the deep ball as well. D.D. Westbrook, a really, really intriguing player. Stacy Coley from Miami, 6 foot, 195 pounds, bigger than Westbrook, bigger than Taylor, but still has that mid 4.4 speed I expect him to be. Just a little bit under 4.45 at the combine next in a few weeks here in Indianapolis. I think Coley is a really impressive player. Can probably fit more in the slot at the next level. Same thing with Cooper Kupp, 6'1", 198 pounds, really good hands, really good ball skills. More quick than he is fast, but Kupp is a guy that has intrigued a lot of people throughout the process. And then Zay Jones, 6'2", 202 pounds, more like Jordan Matthews, kind of a big slot receiver that I think can fit and be a matchup guy inside. It's a question of, we'll see how he tests out in Indianapolis, if that'll change how people view about his athletic ability to line up outside the numbers and win in the NFL. But really good hands, really good ball skills. I do like his size. Like I said, it's 6'2", 202. So thanks to Musafa and all of you out there for your continued support of this show and all the rest of our podcast offerings on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. Okay, let's keep the show going. I told you earlier, I'd get to my notes on a really intriguing prospect of your choosing. So let's get to that player now in our scouting report.
Dim those lights. We're headed to the film room for the scouting report.
All right, so this week on Scouting Report, it didn't take much pushing for me to want to cover Hassan Reddick from Temple, who was one of the best players down at the Senior Bowl a couple weeks ago down in Mobile, Alabama. And so when one of you guys brought him up, I said, you know what, let's cover Hassan, because I know I've gotten a lot of questions about him and how he could potentially transition into a defense like Jim Schwartz here in Philadelphia. So Reddick came in at the Senior Bowl at 6'1 and a half, 237 pounds. Remember, he played defensive end, so for him to come in at 6'1 and a half, 237, you realize why everyone thinks he's going to have to make the move to the linebacker spot. He was a first-team all-conference player this year after leading the entire country in tackles for loss. Really interesting story. You know, in high school in Camden, he was a standout running back and safety. He began his career at Temple as a gray shirt walk-on cornerback, then eventually slid to strong side linebacker in 2013, and then the next year slid to defensive end, and he was a two-year starter there. Keep in mind that all these notes I'm about to read for you were before I watched him live in Mobile. So you'll get to hear a lot of if he makes the move to linebacker and potentially making the move off the ball. Well, now after seeing him in Mobile, there's no doubt about it. I think this kid can definitely play as a stacked linebacker, whether it's in a 4-3 or a 3-4 scheme. But let's get to the notes. Two-year starter at defensive end in Phil Snow's 4-3 scheme at Temple. Lined up to the boundary anywhere from 6 technique, 7 technique, over the tight end, but also standing up. He was sometimes was stacked over the ball as a spy. Played a lot of the game against South Florida there and the athletic, diverse offense they have there with the Bulls down in South Florida. Really explosive kid. He's got a great first step off the ball. Overall, is a great athlete for the position. I would even consider him a great athlete by linebacker standards in the NFL. Really easy mover that can penetrate into the backfield, change direction quickly, and close from behind. He's got the speed of a linebacker to out-leverage those perimeter runs, and you saw that time and time again on tape. As a pass rusher, the kid gets it. I mean, his go-to move is a basic speed rush, but he uses a chop. He uses a club rip. He's got a swim move inside. He's got a bull rush. He's got a long arm. Very effective kid on stunts. So if you're going to play him at linebacker, he's going to be a really good blitzer for you, both up the middle and off the edge. He's a really good backside run defender as well. Knows when to stay home and when to pursue. We saw so many plays of Brandon Graham this past season in Philadelphia making plays from the backside. You saw a lot of that same thing from Hassan Reddick at Temple this past year. When he lined up stacked as a linebacker, he showed the ability, flashed the ability to defeat blocks with his hands. He used a swim move to stay square to the line of scrimmage, never lose sight of the ball and make a play. He's a solid tackler. He looks to wrap up. And while he did have his share of misses, I do think that he'll get more comfortable in this area as he gets more reps as a linebacker attacking the ball downhill. He dropped in coverage at times, has plenty of experience in zone concepts, and showed the ability to make plays on the ball in space. And I got to see that in person down in Mobile as well. So the kid's got great versatility, has a motor that never stops, consistently displays fanatical pursuit to the football, which I love, especially transitioning to the NFL. Now, from a negative standpoint, his lack of size will likely, again, probably, almost certainly, will force a move to linebacker in the NFL. In the run game as a defensive end, he got moved off his spot, struggled to disengage once a blocker got locked in on him. With his frame, I wasn't sure how much weight he'd be able to put on as a defensive end. So I definitely thought, you know what, this kid's going to have to make that move to linebacker. So it was great to see him do that down in Mobile and have so much success as the practice player of the week at that position. Overall, I view Reddick as a bit of a project, dynamic athlete in the front seven. The big question is going to be, how is he going to handle that move from defensive end to more of an inside stacked linebacker in the NFL? And that's going to be the big thing. He's got pass rush skill. He's got a high motor. He's physical. He's athletic. Has all the tools you want. But how is he going to handle that switch mentally? Had a really good showing down there in Mobile, but it's a matter of how will he build on that moving forward? Will teams be able to trust that he can make that transition effortlessly moving forward into the NFL? So thanks again to Greg Cosell and all of you out there listening, whether you're on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play. You guys know the list by now, especially PhiladelphiaEagles.com and the Eagles mobile app. Thank you. And again, if you get the time, rate the show, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Don't be afraid to leave us a question too, because I'd love the ability to answer it here on the podcast. If there's ever anything specific you want me to hit on in depth, I'll absolutely take requests from all of you out there. So wherever you listen, just go shoot us a comment wherever you listen to the show. All that being said, I think that'll do it. Another show in the books here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. For everybody here at the NovaCare Complex, I'm Fran Duffy. We'll talk to you next week.